works that way. And what really happened was that that night they went in, and the British guys who were driving the water buffaloes weren't quite sure where they were. And I know I was left out because I was too IC of the company, and the company commander took them in. Anyway, he thought he'd find out where they were, and he selected a place on the map and called for artillery fire on it so he could figure out from there where he was. Okay. Unfortunately, the place he called for the attack was where he was standing. So he got hit, and a number of other people were hit and killed. And so early in the morning, I was told to... No, it was that night. That night, I guess it was. Anyway, I was told to go and take over. And the colonel had been hit also, and it was supposed to be from some guys who were right near where this position was. So I sent a patrol down, but we didn't find anybody. And then the water started coming up, and it was at night, and the water starts, we were in the basement, and it started seeping in the basement. So I had to have the whole company in the house because we had no ground around. So we moved up to the first floor, eventually got up onto the second floor, but we had nothing to eat except a bit of bully beef and stuff we had. Well then, by this time there was no action taking place where we were, obviously, but these water buffaloes would keep going by, and we would wave at these guys to come and pick us up, and they'd wave back at us, and nothing happened. And I think finally, I forget, the padre worked some gimmick, I forget what it was, but it was some switcheroo. Anyway, one of the buffaloes came and, or some of the buffaloes came and picked us up, and they took us over to where there was a farm and a bit of a sort of an island and all this. And there were lots of chickens and pigs and things like that. And they started to disappear very rapidly. And finally, by the time the buffaloes picked us up, we certainly had lots of food there anyway. We hadn't managed to get around to cooking it yet, but we had droves of chickens and pigs and everything else. And then went back, and then we were to go forward again into Cleve, which somebody else, I think the 51st Highland Division, I think, had gone in there, I'm not sure. And it had been just absolutely leveled. It was just one big parking lot. That was all that was left out. And then from there, we were moved forward out into the flats of the Rhineland. And I was called up one night. I don't remember the exact place. It doesn't matter too much. But by this time, I'm a company commander, and Larry Henderson, who had been my original company commander, was now colonel of the regiment, called me up and said for me to come forward and then send the troops up behind me that I was to put in an attack, a night attack. And this was to be a night attack with tanks from the Scots Guards. And the area was the Winnipeg Rifles had tried to get into this town, and they'd been thrown out. And so he said, well, you're to put in a night attack with tanks and take this over. And I said, well, there's a whole battalion has been thrown out. I've never seen the area. I'm doing it from a map. And the tanks are blind at night. And I'm supposed to go in there with a company and take this. I said, I don't think that makes a hell of a lot of sense, frankly. Can't you talk the brigadier out of it? He said, well, I think maybe you're right. So he talked to the brigadier, and he talked him out of it. And fortunately, it so happened, the Winnipeg sent a patrol, and the Cherries had buggered off anyway, so it didn't matter. Well, then, but when the troops came up, they came to a field, and the sergeant major brought the troops up there, and he had them all on the field ready to lie down and have a rest. Well, the British had been in the day before, and they must have just got caught in a hell of a machine gun fire, because there were dead Brits all over the field. And I found here that some of these poor guys, some of them had never been in action before, were bedded down next to a dead Englishman. And I said, look, for God's sake, get these dead bodies at least in one place and away from where the troops are, because the poor guy that's going to go into action tomorrow morning sure doesn't want to see what happened yesterday. And so we did. Well, then the next day, I was called on to lead an attack with two companies. And this time I was able to go forward and have a look at it and see what I was in for. And it was with the Scots Guards, the tank outfit. And anyway, when we were discussing the plan with the colonel, the major from the Scots Guards was there, and he said, well, and very British, he said, we prefer to go ahead. I said, well, geez, you're just the guy I've been looking for. He said, well, we'll go ahead except when you come to the buildings. And then he said, you have to clear those out. And then he said, when you clear the buildings, you put up a flare. So we went in, and we didn't come have any trouble when we started in, and actually there was nobody in the position. But when we finally got through and got up on a hill, it was a big field sort of thing, the Germans had been expecting that that's what we would do, and so they had mortars lined up for every place that made any sense, and they had machine guns covering the hill. So they were bringing very heavy machine gun fire and mortar fire on us. My company went in first, and then the other company was supposed to come behind. Well, of course, they caught him in a lot of mortar fire. He was supposed to go on through, and he couldn't do it. He just had to dig in. And in the meantime, we just dug in and held the thing, and we couldn't move during the daytime at all, so we'd go back at night. But I guess he figured we'd be bringing our grub up to the buildings, and so he had tracer machine gun fire going across there. And one officer that didn't have anything better to do started counting the number of shells and bombs that came into this area, and it was 128 in 1 hour. It was about two every minute were coming into it. And we lost a lot of men there. We had very heavy casualty, even though we were dug in well. And mortar bombs were landing right in slip trenches. One couple of kids were sitting there. There was a lance corporal and a private, and this bomb came in, hit the lance corporal right in the chest, where he just vanished. The other kid is littered with bits of shrapnel, and of course he was in complete shell shock. The officer who was in charge was some poor guy from the forestry corps and had no training at all. He just come up, and for some reason, which is rather obscure to me and probably still to him, he decided to bury the corporal. And by this time he was just shaking, you know, and came over to me, and my sergeant major had gone back, and he left me. He always carried a water bottle full of rum for, you know, just to medicinal purposes. So I started pouring rum into this guy, and I poured a couple for myself, and finally he wasn't getting any better, and so I said, look, you better get back, because you're going to have me doing this pretty soon. And then, I forget how many days, we weren't there maybe only about 3 days, but then finally we were ordered to put in another attack, and it was supposed to be an attack by stealth. And I was getting the orders just before daybreak, but it was obvious that it wasn't going to be stealth, it was going to be broad daylight. So I thought, well, maybe we'd have some ground fog. And I told my guys to just drop their packs off by some houses and we'd see if we could make it through. We had German paratroops in front of us at this time, and they were pretty fair quality people. And anyway, we started in, and I was going to have to go over a forward slope again in broad daylight against a bunch of paratroops, and we just got started and came under quite heavy fire, bazookas and machine guns. So I said, nothing doing, I'm not going to, you know, have a charge of the light brigade here. Unfortunately, there was one other company, and the Germans let them get in, and then they cut them off, and just, well, there was, the fellows they didn't kill were practically all taken prisoner. But when we finished up, I think there was 128 men and two officers left, and we'd gone in with a full battalion. We'd been fully reinforced before we went in, so we'd had a pretty bad beating. It was an incident that I'll never forget, too. It refers to the pipes, because when we were finally ordered out, 2IC sent up a company piper for each company. It was at night. And this one company had 5 men left, that was all. I think I had the biggest company. I had about 50 or 60 men left. And we started marching back behind the lines then, and the paper, I think it was a wild Scotsman by the name of Wee Andy McGeorge, I think it was my company paper, and he asked the boys, what'll they have? And he said, the Yellow Cock of the North. And, you know, these guys were so tired after 3 or 4 days, they had virtually no sleep, they'd been under very heavy fire, and were tired out. Anyway, they started back, and we were going through the lines of the 51st Highland Division again. And some of the jocks, of course, when they heard the pipes, put their heads out and says, "Water's there." And some kid yelled out, "It's the Canadian Scottish, what's left of them." We went back to a place called Bedburg, and when we were, as we came in, the colonel had the whole pipe band out there to play us in, played the regimental march past. And I don't think I've ever been so thrilled in my life. These guys just straightened up as if they'd just gone on parade that, you know, 15 minutes before, and marched past. The old regimental sergeant major was a pretty tough old character. Had been a permanent force, Imperial soldier. Came out, tears were running down his face. Shook my hand, you know, "Good show, sir," this sort of thing. It was one of the most emotional things I think I've ever gone through. So then we had a rest there, and I took over the company that had been wiped out. By this time, I was promoted to major then, and we reinforced this company. But fortunately, we'd managed to get hold of a few reinforcement officers who had been out and been wounded and came back in again, so that we had a few experienced people come back for a change. And then I was given a bit of a rest after that one. And they fought in a few fairly minor battles then on the way up toward the Rhine, and then we were pulled back into the Reichswald Forest again to get a rest and get built up again. Had a lot of fun in there. Had parties. The whole Canadian, I guess the whole Canadian army practically had been pulled back. And the poor girls who were, we weren't allowed to fraternize with the Germans, and the poor girls who were nurses were having to go to a different party practically every night. You know, I was talking to one of them, and she said, you know, the matron comes along and says she wants volunteers for another party, and the girl said, "Well, not another one," which seems, you know, unbelievable, but, and each regiment was trying to outdo the other one in what kind of a party they would put on. You know, we got the, we knew some guys in the forestry corps, and they start chopping down trees and running them through the sawmills and made a dance floor. And then we went to a nearby German town, and we took all the doors off all the houses and made it into a sort of a big pavilion. And then we got a cow or steer or whatever it was anyway, made a huge big roasting pit and had an enormous barbecue. Some guy had to go all the way back to Belgium to buy champagne. So we did ourselves proud while we were in there, right? And we were... Also, it was a good time for sort of getting the new fellows in the battalion, to get them the feel of what it was in a Scottish regiment. We'd have a parade in the evening, and the pipes would play, and so on and so forth. And so we had a good rest and got ready then to go across the Rhine. this, again, of course, was one of Montgomery's very highly planned attacks. Ours wasn't, the crossing wasn't particularly spectacular as far as we were concerned, because I think it was the 9th Brigade that went across in front of us, and the paratroops had jumped over ahead, and then they put up a floating bridge across the Rhine, but the 2IC, Bill Matthews, decided that we should be piped across. I didn't see why we should advertise the fact, but anyway, in World War I, when we went across the Rhine, we were piped across. Well, of course, nobody was fighting anybody then. It made a difference. But The Germans were trying to bomb the bridge, too, which didn't make things particularly comfortable. You were hoping they didn't take a shot at it just as you were going by. Mm-hmm. They weren't particularly good at it because the bridge was remained intact. And then we started in a more or less a sort of race to try and catch up with them. And I know that one stage there, I didn't get anything to eat for about 24 hours, and I didn't get any sleep. I was just on the move all the time. Just get ready to have something to eat, and they'd call me for an org group. But then I was with, there were two companies out in front, mine and another chap, and we got near the what had been the city of Emmerich. And came along, and there was nothing, it was very quiet, nothing was happening. And there was a big house near a brick factory there, and went up to this and found it was occupied by Dutch people. And we fed them some chocolate bars, and they gave me an egg, and this was quite a find, you know, in those days. Anyway, this story goes with that. But they showed us where all the mines were, and they said, well, they thought the Germans had moved out, but they weren't sure. Well, there was a sort of a creek just in front of the city, and a long sloping field. And in our battle drill training, we'd been taught, if we were on the defensive, to set this up as a killing ground, and that's just what it looked like. So I said, well, who's going to go first? And the other fellow was a captain. He sort of looked at my shoulders, and I said, okay. So I said, well, we'll just feed one platoon across at a time. And I got my company across and one of his platoons. And then the Germans woke up and they started opening up with machine gun fire on us. And we couldn't get any more. So we sort of moved up. And what there was, it had trucks and things along there. And so they had vehicle bays dug in the side of the hill. And we were using these as sort of trenches for protection. And so then I sent one of the fellows, I said, well, you see if you can get around in behind them, go around the side, but there was a railway embankment or something, and I said, don't go over that. You'll probably get in a war all of your own. Of course, he went over to the other side and got in a war all of his own. And I think, first of all, I forget how it happened, he saw these Germans coming at him, and he waved them down, and he told them that they were surrounded and they should surrender. And the German officer didn't think that was probably true. So anyway, he got shot right through the lungs. And so during the day, I had carefully dug a little hole and put this egg in the bank, you see, and not having eaten much, I thought, you know, boy, I'm going to have a real breakfast here. Well, then his runner, they sent a runner back to see if they could get some help for this platoon that was in trouble. And of course, you guess where the runner jumped, right on top of my egg. Well, then, by this time, the Germans were moving in. We were throwing hand grenades at each other, you know, just a matter of a few feet away. And ours were better than theirs, and I think we were getting better results. But anyway, this officer in front said he was getting into trouble. I said, well, you know, pull your guys a little closer in. And then an artillery officer came up and said, can I give you a hand? I said, yeah, put some smoke down and we'll see if we can get this platoon out. Well, he started pulling smoke down, and I think the Germans thought there was an attack coming in, and they started pulling back at the same time we were pulling back. So there were troops going, German going this way and a Canadian going this way, running almost shoulder to shoulder at times. But we didn't get him out. We got his platoon out that night. And then we had to do a night attack so we'd get further into the city so that the tanks could get in. And we lost a few fellows in that action. And then the Regina rifles moved in and the tanks moved in and got a little further in. And then I was ordered to put in another attack so that we could get further into the city, pretty well clean it out. And I know about this time, about the time I heard the machine guns opening up, I thought, you know, geez, I don't want to go out there at all. But it wasn't, didn't turn out too bad. They we had brought some tanks along, and they had flamethrowers. And the Germans found us quite discouraging. So we had a little trouble. We didn't have too many losses to get in there and achieve the job we were supposed to do. And then we were moved over to another side, another side of Emmerich. Again, we came under a certain amount of fire, but nothing particularly rough. I remember the padre decided to have a church service about that. It was very well attended. I think everybody feeling they'd like to have a little support from up above if they could get it. That was about all that seemed to happen around there that I can remember. After all, it's a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And then we moved further in up into Germany, and then moved across the border into Holland. And again, we were trying to catch up with the German troops. We really didn't know where they were. The reconnaissance units were out looking for them too, and hadn't had too much trouble. So I was, after Emmerich, I was getting very short of people. I only had one officer left, and one sergeant, I think, and a sergeant major, as far as NCOs and officers are concerned. So I was given a job as what they called advance to contact, and I did training in this in the 2nd Division, and it was quite a, theoretically it was quite an idea. It was a company of artillery and a troop a company of infantry and a troop of artillery, a section of anti-tank guns, a section of mortars, and a section of carriers, so you really had a lot of firepower. And in our training, why, you were supposed to go up the road with your troops, and somebody would shoot at you from up front, and then you would bring in all this and start going around them, and so on and so forth. Anyway, when the colonel told me about this, I said, well, look, I've only got 36 men left. I was supposed to have 125. And I said, I've only got one officer. Boys, I've got some reinforcements for you. And he had one officer and 15 men. And the one officer came up and he said, well, I think he had been in the artillery. And he said, I haven't had much training, as I just had a battle drill school. So I said, well, you're going to get the postgraduate course right now, because you're going to lead the, going to be leading the attack. And we just got started and came under machine gun fire. And I was getting a little cautious. We knew the war was pretty near the end. But the machine gun fire seemed to be coming from some buildings over on our flank. And that wasn't in the book. So I went to the artillery officer and I said, can you hit those buildings with your artillery? And he said, well, no, my guns are off doing another job right now. So I went to the mortars and I said, well, can you put down smoke in front of the building so I can get moving? He said, no, I've only got 3 smoke bombs left. And I guess I forgot about my anti-tank guns, but anyway, I asked the carriers and they came in with flamethrowers and gung-ho and went all through. But then I found that one of the problems I had was that the guy at the very front was one little soldier who'd just been sent over as a reinforcement, and he got his head down and he wasn't set to go anywhere, and everybody was held up behind him. Anyway, we got moving, and that night we were going through liberating one farm at a time, and they were offering us glasses of milk and so on. And it was quite eerie, because one person would tell you, you know, well, they think the Germans are up at the next crossroads, they've got a post up there. And you'd wonder if you were going to get blown to hell the next minute or something, or walk into an ambush. Anyway, finally I said, well, just sling your rifles over your shoulder and let's get going. And we had to go to a, a little place called D-Dam. We got in there about 3 o'clock in the morning, and it was quite funny, because we banged on the door of this house, and the people came to the door. They were terrified. They thought the Germans were going to move them all out of the town. And then when they heard it was the Canadians, they let out a yelp, and they were being fed chocolate bars and things like this, and it was quite a moving experience. Anyway, I got my troops, what I had of them, distributed, and I looked behind me, and I saw some other guys, and I thought, well, that's Joe Andrews and his people. And I thought, gee, that's funny. They got overcoats on. And our guys never wore overcoats. In other words, the Germans were getting out as we were getting in. And I really didn't have much. That was really the end of my experience. I was supposed to put in the lead the attack into Deventer the next day, or a couple of days later. But unfortunately, I got enteritis and had to go back to hospital. And by the time I got back, the troops were moving. We were up into Germany, and my 2IC had then taken over the company. And I didn't have any active work until finally, of course, VE Day, and we marched into through our city of Aurich and went to a posted in a near a an old German Air Force base. Well, then there wasn't any fighting, but it's relevant. It was rather an interesting sidelight. I was sent up forward to I don't remember the town in Germany. It's on the road to Wilhelmshaven, and they had a tremendous scheme called Eclipse, so that when the war was over, everybody would know exactly what to do and what you were supposed to do in German cities and so on. They told everybody except the guys who were going to be doing it. So Colonel told me I was to go and take over this town, and I said, what am I supposed to do? Well, he said, I don't know, just use your head. He said, I guess that's all, just do whatever you think is sensible. So I sent my 2IC up ahead, and he came back, and he said, well, there's some German barracks there that we could use, and but he said there's a couple of Poles raising hell up there in the town. So I went up, and there was a Polish officer and a Polish corporal, and they were raising hell with the Germans. And what it was all about, there was one of these slave labor camps there, and they were all Poles. So he had the Burgermeister out and giving him a dressing down. So I said, well, look, this isn't your backyard. I'm supposed to be in charge here, so I better take over. So I told the Burgermeister, I said, look, there was a German hospital just across the road, and it was mostly empty. So I said, I want all these people moved over and provided with beds and bedding in that hospital tomorrow morning. I want cutlery, I want plates, knives and forks, everything. I said, we'll provide the food because I know you haven't got it. And I want want them to be able to get cleaned up and have showers and all the rest of it. These poor people were grossly underfed. They were all vermin infested and in pretty bad shape. They had them all just jammed into an old barn of sorts. It wasn't a big camp, but it was big enough. So. Then this Polish corporal said, well, you should get some beer for the troops and some schnapps for the officers. That's a good idea. He was interpreting all the time for them. So the Burgermeister agreed that he'd find the beer and the schnapps for us. And then the corporal said, well, you shouldn't be driving around in a truck, you know. He said, you should have something better than that. So I heard him explaining a Mercedes-Benz, you know. and the poor Burgermeister was very upset. He couldn't find a Mercedes-Benz, but he had a Packard Roadster. And could they have it back when I was through with it? So we agreed that that would be all right. And so we moved in, and then they knew far more about what they were supposed to do than we did, because they'd collected all the weapons, even including shotguns and old swords and everything else. The Poles had been in and raided this the arms, and they had swiped most of the pistols and things that were in use. But anyway, they collected all that. They collected all the radios in case, because they thought that we would be not allow them to listen to radios or anything like that. And they were pretty well organized. Well, then there was one policeman in the town, and I said, "Well, look, I had no authority, but I said, look, I want to." I'm going to have a curfew here at 9 o'clock. I want everybody off the streets, and I'm going to put my troops around the streets, and if I find anybody in the street, we'll shoot them. Now, of course, we had no intention of doing it, but I figured it'd scare the hell out of them anyway. Well, then the policeman said, well, can I keep my gun? And I thought, well, you know, he had a sidearm. I thought, you know, probably it'd be just as well to have in my side. So I agreed that he could still carry his gun, and that was fine. He kept face then, and he was so on. But we just stayed in there for a couple of days, and then for some reason that I never understood, it was taken over by the Poles, and of course they just moved in and started, last I saw them, they had a bunch of German girls in their cars and wheeling around, yelling and drinking and raising hell. I wasn't too impressed with them sometimes. And we were moved back into Holland then. And my company was sent to a little town called Abcoude, just outside of Amsterdam. And we were the first troops in, and we were welcomed with open arms. And I think that's what it was. There was a bunch of German prisoners that we had to sort out and send back. And it must have been before that that we had them. Anyway, the thing I remembered was that the British troops had been looking after these guys, and they said, we always take them out for route march very early in the morning because the Dutch people all spit at them and throw stones at them. And so I said, well, I'm going to get up early in the morning to please these guys. They'll go out on a route march when I feel like it, not when they feel like it. And if somebody spits on them, that's their tough luck. We didn't have any real trouble there. But we had then, of course, their experiences in Holland were just great. And that really is, that was my war.
Okay. And when did you get home?
Well, I was in Holland until, what was it, about July, I guess it was, something like that, and then hung around in England for a while, and I was in charge of a draft that got home. I was sent back to Regina, because my home at that time was in Moose Jaw, and so I brought a trainload of guys home, arrived home on day after VJ Day, and like 2 days after, because it was the 16th of August.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about, or any subject we haven't covered?
I can't think of anything much. I think I've done a fair.
Okay.